This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, what happened to house calls? If you're a poet, you know the problem. Poetry doesn't pay. So unless you were born into money, or you married up, as they say, you'll have to earn a living. Many poets teach. Others write ad copy, wait tables, deliver mail, work in accounting. The most romantic-sounding combination, I always thought, was medicine and poetry. Take William Carlos Williams, one of the most important American modernists. When he wasn't revolutionizing poetry, he drove around the borough of Rutherford, New Jersey, making house calls. I don't even know if doctors still do those. So, what is it like then, being a poet doctor today? I asked two people who would know. Fadi Juda, a recent Guggenheim fellow who practices internal medicine in Houston, Texas, and Amit Majmudar, the first poet laureate of Ohio and a nuclear radiologist in Columbus. Well, they told me what it's not like. Here's Amit Majmudar, comparing his day-to-day to that of William Carlos Williams.
He, as you know, was an OB-GYN. And with an OB-GYN, you know, you're on call, and at any moment, the patient could deliver, and then you have to rush in and kind of handle the delivery, which is how William Carlos Williams actually practiced. And he was right there at the moment when human beings were entering the world, you know? He was at the sort of border between life, you know, birth and death and everything, because there was a high infant mortality back then, high maternal mortality back then. So he was kind of in the thick of it as far as the very basic elements of just human existence, right?
Yeah.
With me, it's shift work. I'm a radiologist. So it's a very, very detached, clean, removed specialty within medicine. I go into a room in the basement of the hospital. It's a dark room. I have these enormous computer screens around me. And I just start working through cases. It's basically you're preparing reports for clinicians to read, the clinician that actually sees the patient. I, as a radiologist, I look at the images that the patient has gotten scanned, and I just look at them on a computer and send out the report. And most days of my career, I actually don't encounter patients, believe it or not.
I saw that you're an internist. So if you don't mind, like what, you know, how should I imagine your day-to-day?
The world of medicine now is so specialized that even within internal medicine, you'll find people who do clinics and people who do hospital work.
Mm.
Currently, I work as a hospitalist who's just an internist who manages patient care when they're admitted to the hospital.
So what does that look like? Do you have an office and people come in, or you do
no,
you visit
I,
rooms?
No, I just, I roam the hospital corridors.
First, I wanted to ask you to describe it in layman's terms. But then I saw a poem that you wrote about radiology. And,
oh, sure.
And I thought we should just read that, you know?
Yeah, I can do that.
So it's in Dot Head. It's on page 76.
Sure. Picture the fibrous spoke wheel scaffold of an infinitely thin wafer of orange held to a window. Trans-illuminated in its circumference of rind. Now picture a volume of human, reduced to planes and fluttering under my thumb like a flipbook, showing the disease in action. Every one of those planes, hundreds of lines stacked tight enough to resolve the speck not yet a lump. Every one of those lines, a string of pixels end to end, razor luminous horizon round a darkening world. Each pixel, a point geometry defines dimensionless, no height, no width, no depth. I see what ails the body by regressing body back to spirit. the volume a stack of planes, the plane a row of lines, the line a string of points, and the point at last nothing at all, all form substanceless by radiologic proof. I read no images more imaginary than the mind's, every layer of it immaterial, the gray matter, the white matter, the dark.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you.
I love that image of you thumbing through a flip book, you know, showing an animation almost of the disease. I was also struck by a volume of human reduced. I thought it was actually a sort of terrifying. Do you feel like that's a risk, especially in your branch of medicine being so high tech and, you know, you sitting in your basement,
right,
not seeing too much of patients, that doctors end up seeing patients as a volume of human reduced?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think that it doesn't just hold true of radiology. It actually is increasingly holding true of clinical medicine as a whole. In order to break even, clinicians are compelled to schedule as many patients as they can during their work hours in order to make ends meet from a business perspective. And those are actual patient-doctor interactions. You know, as far as radiology is concerned, I think that that is the default or almost the baseline to regard the human as just volume, pixels, images, because that's all they are to us, really.
It really is a fruit basket. A person who comes in needing care for pneumonia is going to require a few different things than one who comes in for heart failure or for infectious complications from diabetes or kidney failure or. And of course, in many cases, as we've turned many of these diseases into chronic entities, a lot of people come in with all these things present at the same time. And so you end up working with other specialists in order sort of to divvy up the burden.
All right.
And also to keep the, to prop up the powerful economy of the medical establishment. I think it's the second largest industry in America.
Yeah.
After the military.
Life
and death are so closely entwined.
Aren't they? Yeah.
Believe it or not, every year for the past 10 years, I've read about 16,000 cases. So that's, that's 160,000 patients over the past 10 years.
Wow.
That I've helped in some way. Hopefully I've helped in some way. We do that in mostly in two-dimensional anatomy. So it's not as though there's a three-dimensional liver that we can look at. We look at slices through the liver. So it reduces the volume of the human being literally to a plane. Often, you know, a few thousand of them, but that's how we interpret the disease. That's how we actually help the patient. We're interacting with data. Mm-hmm. We're interacting with lines, dots, shapes, disruptions of the normal anatomic pattern in a human being.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to give you a running narration of what I'm thinking as I'm doing it, it would sound very repetitive and it would sound like a computer almost.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to look at the liver. I'm going to look at the spleen. I'm going to look at the pancreas. I'm going to look at the aorta. I'm going to look at the mesenteric vessels. And that's why if you talk to the people who are developing AI, one of their great goals is to replace radiologists by, you know, the end of the next decade. I wish them luck. I doubt it. I think that AI is most likely going to become an adjunct to what radiologists do.
Right.
And I think the reason for that is that they're going to need a human being to sue. You know what I'm saying? If something goes wrong. IBM is not going to want to take on the liability for 160,000 patients times all the radiologists in the country.
Let me just jump in here because this is getting kind of dark and I thought I could tell you a story. The story is about William Carlos Williams. A few years after he retired, him and his friend Kenneth Burke, a literary critic, were in Florida, slowly walking on the beach. They brought a neighbor's dog, but the dog was walking funny, limping. The literary critic wants to know what's wrong, so he leans over the dog and stretches out his hand, and the dog gets scared, almost bites him. Then it's William's turn. He takes the dog's paw in his hand, confident but gentle, and with his doctor's touch, he starts feeling around between the toes and pulls out a metal shard so fast the dog doesn't even peep. That doctor's touch is special, isn't it?
One of the difficult things that I encountered, and I don't think I'm unique in this, in the practice of medicine, is this kind of power you hold over your patients, right? Sometimes I'll get to decide whether, you know, the abdominal pain you feel is abdominal pain or not, when it's not my body. It's really a modern medicine is a window into the administered world in the most beautiful, romantic, heroic, and catastrophic and vile means anyone can imagine if one really opens up to those possibilities, or actually realities, on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I think these are, you know, it's really complicated. And I don't think that the medical establishment or society in America really is that deeply honest with itself about these things. You know, we always want to hold on to this idea of romanticizing a physician that we know, whether that physician happens to be the one who, quote unquote, saved your life, or happens to be a poet, or happens to be an occasional contributor to The New Yorker, et cetera, et cetera. Often it comes with a sense of exceptionalism that bugs me. And of course, everybody now will say, I understand that the medical establishment is now an institution, and it's about capital and power and all this stuff. But God forbid I have a particular illness. I don't want to care about any of that. I just want to get well by any means necessary.
You know, it almost feels like, in a sense, you are closer to the disease than you are to the human being.
That's what we look for. That's what I hunt for every day. And if I lose my focus, if I think about this as, oh, this is Jim, you know, or if I think that, oh, how sad that this, you know, 28-year-old has metastatic cancer, that is actually harmful to the patient, because it takes my mind off of the systematic way in which a radiologist has to interpret the entire study. There have been a few times that it has broken through, but those have been very rare instances. And the instances that stick out in my memory have been when doctors who have catastrophic diagnoses have come back to see their own scans with me. It's a very, very fraught moment. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, because they have a lot of knowledge. They say, hey, have the lymph nodes come back? Is there ischemia in that part of my heart again? And I know what's going through their head, because I too am a physician, and I too have had my share of health scares, some invented, to be honest with you, because we tend to be terrible hypochondriacs. But in this case, they come back, they enter that dark, isolated office of the radiologist, and they're scared to death.
Yeah.
And sometimes I get to say, hey, you know, your bone scan's clean. You got another year before you got to do this again. See ya. You know, have a great year. But there have been times where I've had to say, the lymph nodes are back. They're worse than last time. And literally, I had a doctor, a colleague, tell me, I got to go talk to my lawyer, my estate planner. I got to get some stuff in line, because he knew that it was a death sentence. And that's,
you don't even have to tell them.
I don't have to tell them that, look, it's over. You failed therapy, it's over, it's done. They know it. That's why they came back. They had to see for themselves. And they have this image then of their own interior. They have this image of their own disease having gotten the better of them. And it's just a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Progress notes. The age of portrait is drugged. Beauty is symmetry so rare, it's a mystery. My left eye is smaller than my right. My big mouth shows my nice teeth perfectly aligned like Muslims in prayer. My lips an accordion, each sneeze a facial thumbprint. One corner of my mouth hangs downward when I want to hold a guffaw hostage. Bell's palsy, perhaps, or what Mark Twain said about steamboat piloting, that a doctor's unable to look upon the blush in a young beauty's face without thinking. It could be a fever, a malar rash, a butterfly announcing a wolf. Can I lie face down now as cadavers posed on first anatomy lesson? I didn't know mine was a woman until 3 weeks later we turned her over. Out of reverence, there was to be no untimely exposure of donors, our patrons who were covered in patches of scrubs, green dish towels. And by semester's end we were sick of all that. Tossed mega livers and mammoth hearts into lab air and caught them. My body was Margaret. That's what the death certificate said when it was released before finals. The cause of her death? Nothing memorable. Frail old age. But the colonel on table 19 with an accessory spleen had put a bullet through his temple, a final prayer. Not an entry or exit were there skull cracks to condemn the house of death, no shattered glass in the brain, only a smooth tunnel of deep violet that bloomed in concentric circles. The weekends were lonely. He had the most beautiful muscles of all 32 bodies that were neatly arranged, zipped up as if a mass grave had been disinterred. Or, when unzipped and facing the ceiling, had cloth over their eyes as if they'd just been executed. Gray silver hair, chiseled countenance. He was 67, a veteran of more than one war. I had come across that which will end me, extend me at least once without knowing it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You start this poem with a description, sort of a self-deprecating description of your own anatomy. My left eye is smaller than my right. And then you go on, one corner of my mouth hangs downward when I want to hold a guffaw hostage. And then you cut through to an image of a different person's anatomy in med school, where each student has a cadaver to study. And I'm so interested in that because for most people, the body is, it's like this weird idiosyncratic, unpredictable thing that just has its demands at the most impractical times, you know, and we kind of know it intimately in this way that we would never share with anyone. But then as a doctor, you have to learn to see the body as something like almost standardized, like almost generic, you know, like in this case, you don't even know that the body is a woman until weeks later when you turn her over. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, do you remember that evolution when you were in school, of having the body become something distant and almost objective?
Yeah. I think it's a... I mean, we didn't even think that whether this was a man or a woman. Because we had to work in these kind of sequential pattern, you know, layer by layer, muscle by muscle, etc. We couldn't, the body wasn't totally uncovered. It was, you only uncovered the parts that you were working on.
I see.
And so there was this kind of both short-sightedness and practicality to it, because you were going to get tested on it. But I remember our profound surprise when we when we discovered it was a woman. And then after that, you're like, well, what was her name? And my group was four guys, where we did not have a woman student with us, which she might have, you know, pointed out our stupidity early on in the class and said, well, maybe this looks like a woman's body, you idiots. You know, but I just, there is something about the oversight that leads itself to violence.
This unease that you feel about sort of the role as savior and profiteer, I mean, maybe not you, but sort of as part
of this
larger system.
I'm not going to exclude myself of that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Is that something that dawned on you as you were working, or did you always already realize that?
You know, I think that I always felt it or embraced it in a maybe subconscious sense. Or, of course, I became more aware of it as I was in training. But it took me many years to recognize, well, I think that, you know, I grew up subconsciously aware that there was trauma and distress in my family because they were separated by becoming Palestinians dispossessed of land and refugees. And I remember the setting was in an apartment. A bunch of family was around, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles. And somebody asked, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And I remember my answer is that I want to be a physician because I want to buy a house big enough to gather all of you in it and then take care of you when you get ill.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting to feel like between health and wealth lay some secret for happiness. And that was my instinctive response to that.
Actually, my brother-in-law is a radiologist, and I saw his path. I talked to a lot of people. And for me, it came down to two potential specialties: radiology and pathology, because both of those are what are called non-clinical specialties. You're not actually going in to see patients every day. You don't have an office. You don't, you know, go into rooms and then have human interactions and then move on and always be on call and things like that. It's shift work. Mm-hmm. It's very contained. And I did that. I selected that on purpose because from my, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, I had in my mind that I'm going to be a writer.
Wow. Growing up, did you have a lot of poetry around the house?
My father would tell me historical or even personal narratives that began or ended with famous poetic lines from Arabic literature. And then he would have, you know, always a sense of drama in presenting the poetic line about it. and my uncle, who grew up a Palestinian refugee, was born in a refugee camp, had a leaning to contemporary Arabic poetry and to Arabic literature in general. So every now and then, whenever he'd come to visit, I remember him asking me to memorize a few poems or a few lines and giving me coins for it. And and we used to have this famous game, students, of reciting poetry lines to each other in a sort of a competition. We'd split into two teams. You know, you start with a famous poetic line, and the rhyme that ends the line, or say the last phoneme in the last word, would have to be the first letter that you begin your line with in order to keep playing.
Oh, wow. Wait, so it's not about rhyme then. It's sort of like a chain or something.
Right.
So right?
It's sort of like a crown of sonnets, but it's based on letters. Letters ending the line and letters beginning them.
Yeah.
And it gets really tough. And so you have to be clever and always have, there are always a couple of letters that are impossible to find lines that begin with them, except like a handful. And so everyone would like, you'd have to memorize those because they're going to stump you.
Yeah.
But there was some sense of, you know, there was pride in it, right? First of all, it meant mm-hmm. that you were smart, that you had good memory, and you were cultured.
Yeah.
On the one hand. On the other hand, I also felt just joyously intoxicated by the whole event.
I was actually born in the United States, and then we moved back to India when I was in second grade, and I did a few years in India, and then we moved back to the United States, and I went back to the exact same school and the exact same classmates that I'd left back in second grade, only now I was a fourth grader. Yet I felt like completely different than, like I'd undergone some sort of sea change internally. And then it was a question for me of like, you know, wait a minute, do I erase what was Indian about me? I picked up two languages. I had, you know, all these relatives that I knew now. Do I just kind of let that go and just become the person that I would have become if I'd never gone to India? Or do I really hold on to this thing that was no longer part of my day-to-day, but had changed me in these ways? Do I hold on to that and then keep myself alienated from the mainstream of the culture that I was in now and was going to be in for the rest of my life? I suddenly realized that, look, all these kids around me, they don't have the insight into their own culture the way that I have insight into both the culture of my parents and the culture that they're in. That was a eureka moment where I was like, wait, this is like the greatest thing ever. I suddenly have like this third position where I can kind of look at these ways of being. I don't have to choose. So literature and science, or I can do science and yet I study religion. You know, I'm actually a pretty religious person. I do a lot of work within, translation of ancient Indian scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, which is my most recent book. I can kind of move back and forth, gain insights from one, gain insights from the other, all these different ways of looking at the universe, the physical and the metaphysical. It's an advantage, and I try and turn it to my advantage whenever I sit down at the computer and write.
That unease that you feel as a doctor, as a poet, is that also why you write?
No, I think I write because... I mean, there are a million other feelings that come, you know, and burdens and pains and struggles and griefs and et cetera. But in the end, it's just this compulsion to write and to sing as I write and to kind of discover and read and, you know, and it's just it's almost keeping a fragment of a lost childhood alive forever.
Fadi Juda is the author of four collections of poetry, most recently Footnotes in the Order of Disappearance. His debut, The Earth in the Attic, was chosen in 2008 as winner of the Yale Series of Younger Poets by Louise Glick. He also made lauded translations of the works of Mahmoud Darwish and other Palestinian or Arabic-speaking poets. Amit Majmudar also wrote four poetry collections, most recently Dothead, besides two novels, many essays, and a translation in verse of the Bhagavad Gita, God's Song, which the New York Times described as ravishing and faithful. You can find more about both poets on the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.